Okay, good morning. It is May 8th at 9 a.m., and we are located here at Eureka City Hall, City Council Chambers at 531 K Street, room 208, Eureka. My name is Alex Hart, and I am the chair of the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, and I'd like to call this meeting to order. This meeting is being webcast and recorded. This is a hybrid meeting with both in-person and virtual participation options. Members of the public who wish to address the board may do so in person or through the Zoom application. For those who want to listen and watch the meeting but not comment, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card and give it to the clerk. If you intend to comment virtually, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and password you receive from the clerk. If you have not already received the meeting ID and password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/North Coast. Click on the May 7th, 8th button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with a Zoom login information. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you'll be on mute until it is your time to speak on the item you have indicated. When it is your turn to speak, please state your name and affiliation if you are comfortable doing so. There is a normal 5-minute time limit for each public commenter. During public comment, you will see a timer on the screen, and for those calling by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when your time is up. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Please now join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So again, welcome everybody. My name's Alex, and we're going to go from my left to right today, introducing ourselves. If those of you at the end of the dais will pay attention. We're introducing ourselves left to right.
Ayuki Nanithwit D. Molly Myers, Kaduk tribal member from Wichpak. I live in Wichpak, and I'm the newest board member.
Greg Giusti, Yukaya.
Jake McKenzie from the city of Roanoke Park. I'm almost a fully recovered elected official and always glad to be here.
Alex Hart, Siskiyou County.
Hector Bedoya, Northern Sonoma County.
Dale Romani, resident of McKinleyville, California.
Great. So I'm just checking. Valerie, is DD still off?
DD is online now.
I was just sending DD an email, but I haven't sent it yet. But now DD can hear me. I was just going to note, and I'm sorry I didn't think to communicate this when we talked about you giving your update today. Our speakers for our first item are professors, and one of them has to teach at 10 a.m. And so I'm hoping that we can actually go to that information item and then do your report afterwards. Will that work for you, Didi?
Well, I have a hard stop also. I have another meeting that I'm going to. So how long do you expect that item to go?
I am not certain. So I Chair Hart, it's up to you. Would you like to go to Didi's report first, and maybe we can kind of keep the dialogue on that minimal so that we move quickly through it and then move to our information item?
If the board members are amenable to this, if we can just kind of maybe hold off questioning Didi this go around, because we're going to see her again here in a month, and that way Didi can just quick give a report and then get to our next meeting. Does that work? Okay, great. Yeah, Didi, why don't you go ahead and we'll talk to you next month, but we'll hear from you right now.
Okay, and I apologize for lack of flexibility, so I'm going to move really quickly. And I was just before you, actually just a month ago, so it hasn't been that long. So a quick update on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. On April 21st, we received a request from several groundwater sustainability agencies in the Tule Subbasin. And the request was for exclusion of fees, which is something that we had done for a couple of other GSAs. And we received, I believe it was 7 or 8 requests. We took it seriously. Our staff spent a lot of time going through, but we did not feel that they met the mark of updated plans that showed enough progress with sustainability to warrant exclusion from fees. This basin is in probation, and we felt that it was important to reject those requests. So May is a very important month for us because this is the first time that we will actually be imposing state board fees in areas that are under probation. So this is the first time that they have to report their extractions and submit fees. We have a fee stakeholder process that is ongoing, 3 meetings throughout the year. And so we do expect that folks in those basins will participate actively in that process to just make sure that the fees are for cost recovery and not an excess amount. Moving on to 2 of the petitions that are before our administrative hearings office, I've provided you many updates just on process because we can't talk substance. We're under ex parte restrictions for Sites Reservoir and also for Delta Conveyance. So just a reminder that for Sites Reservoir, there is a draft decision that has been released. We have a public comment period of May 22nd for that project. And then on the Delta Conveyance project, on April 23rd, our staff did release from the Administrative Hearings Office a ruling on the Department of Water Resources objections and a procedural ruling on evidentiary objections. If you're interested in following that in any level of detail, more information can be found on the project webpage. Another important sort of deadline that we've been following here is on the agricultural expert panel. This is their updated, this is the second panel that has convened with many public opportunities for input and public comment, and they've been having their deliberations publicly, and during each deliberation, they open it up for public comment. On March 30th, we released the draft that they had prepared, and we just extended the public comment period to May 4th, and the panel will be holding 2 sessions, one on May 18th and then one on May 27th, and we expect that they'll be deliberating the public comment that they've received and then perhaps making changes to the draft. I know this is something that you all and your staff are closely following, so wanted to make sure you have that date. I do expect that we'll be receiving a final document from them in early June, and that we will have an information item at our board going over the report, not taking any action, but just reviewing it and having public comment at a meeting in June, probably our second meeting. Vapor intrusion, California Department or California Environmental Protection Agency is holding a series of work groups, virtual workshops to get information on EPA's efforts to address vapor intrusion. And there's going to be a updated workshop on May 14th regarding paths to closure and risk management. So if you're interested, if anyone's interested, there is registration required on this on our board website for vapor intrusion. Staff has released a draft order in part granting and in part denying petitions for reconsideration for the McLeod Pitt Hydroelectric Project, and we are accepting written comments until May 13th. I did go over the last time I met with you all on the Shasta River watershed evaluation for the scientific basis report and economic analysis. The public comment period was extended to April 30th. Staff's going through all of that information now, so stay tuned for further updates on that. We do have, staff will be holding two technical workshops on Mono Lake. We received modeling results from a UCLA commission report and had an information item at our board meeting. It got overly technical, and we felt that it was appropriate to continue the discussion focused on these technical issues with respect to the modeling and other issues. So Monday, June 1st, there'll be a workshop and another one on June 4th. Water rights enforcement on May 1st, enforcement issued approximately 266 notice of deficiency to water right holders who failed to file their annual diversion reports. So anything you all can do to help get the word out that what we really want is compliance with those reports, not enforcement actions. And let's see here, workshop for our Clean Water State Revolving Fund Program on the intended use. The annual review of that, public comments are due on May 27th. Safer Advisory Group will be holding a meeting on May 28th, if folks are interested in following that. And then lastly, I hope to see many of you at the annual Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting of all the regional boards that's next week in Sacramento. Okay, I tried to go as quickly as I could. There's a lot going on, and especially wanted to get dates out there for these quite a few workshops that are going on and opportunities for public input.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dee Dee. And several of us will be seeing you next week at QCC. So, yep, good luck with the rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Thank you, Chair Hart and board members.
Thank you. Okay, so now moving on to agenda item 4, update on the North Coast Regional Synthesis Report for California's fifth climate assessment. We will now hear on an informational item to discuss the North Coast Regional Synthesis Report of California's fifth climate assessment. The board will hear from staff and interested persons and may provide comments and directions to staff, but the board will take no formal action on this item. We will begin with a presentation from staff and partners that is expected to last 40 minutes, followed by comments from interested persons. Interested persons are generally limited to 5 minutes. Board member questions and comments, other than those clarifying the materials presented in the slides, should be held until after the staff presentation or until there is a break in the presentations for questions. We will now begin, so when you're ready.
Okay, thank you. If I'm not loud enough, please let me know. My name's Rosemary Sheriff, and I'm a professor at Cal Poly Humboldt in the Geography, Environment, and Spatial Analysis Department, and I'm co-leading this discussion today with my lead, Andrew Stubblefield, who's also a professor at Cal Poly Humboldt, and he's in the Forestry, Fire, and Rangeland Management Department. They just changed their name. I hope I got that right. We are here to share a summary of the North Coast Regional Climate Change Synthesis Report that is coming out this summer. So this is only a few people have seen drafts of it. It's nearly complete. It's at the final stages at the editor, and it will be coming out with other regional reports this summer. Just a quick note, too, we have four other lead authors. So two are also professors from Cal Poly Humboldt in the Environmental Science Department, Daniel Leip and Jennifer Marlowe. And David Narum, another lead author, is at the Blue Lake Rancheria, and Keith Parker is a fisheries biologist at the Yurok Tribe. So just a quick outline, I'm gonna give an overview. This is the overview. Andy Stubblefield and I are gonna tag team presenting different components today. Andy will talk about the climate science and sea level rise. I'll talk about the next section, which is natural and working lands and water. We'll talk about built systems, social systems, and then open it up for questions. So in general, the California Climate Change Assessment report that comes out roughly every 6 years or so is focused on these key areas, and this is the one in 2026 that will be coming out. And so The focus areas are on new climate data and scenarios, just overview these, climate energy research reports, core other types of research on climate specific to California and different parts of California. And then there's a tribal research program. And these are overarching for the broader California reports. Within that, there are other types of reports. And the report that we are leading is the regional report for the North Coast. And there are 9 regional reports as well, so in total. So we are one of those regional reports. So this is a timeline that the state developed to develop this report. And so the top shows that there's been the public engagement and outreach throughout this timeline up to present. There was earlier development of climate data and scenarios, and then original climate research throughout this entire time, as well as those core climate reports and tribal research reports. And then the bottom shows that there are other, which is including our report, regional reports, and then there are other topical reports, and then the statewide synthesis report. So one thing I want to point out here is that idea originally was that we, in the regional report, were able to incorporate all of these other reports, but you can see there's overlapping timeline. So our regional report includes new updated information for the North Coast, but may not include all of the information that came out of the energy reports and the core climate reports and some of the tribal research that's coming out at the same time. So I just want to mention that, so that's an important component. So this is a map showing the regional area. So there are 6 counties in the regional report. I know that is slightly different from what the Water Board's regional area is. And we didn't select this. This was selected for us from the state. So this report, maybe I should back up. This report is initiated by the Land Use and Climate Innovation Department out of the governor's office. So they designated these 9 regions, and so the counties that are included in the North Coast Regional Climate Report is Siskiyou, Del Norte, Humboldt, Trinity, Mendocino, and Lake. Some of the counties that I know are part of the North Coast Regional Water Board section are coming into the Central Coast report, the regional report. So the main objective that we were given to develop this North Coast climate assessment is to describe current and predictions of climate changes, describe the natural and working landscapes, our built and social, so infrastructure, for example, and our social systems, and thinking about our vulnerable populations, ecosystems, and economic situations in our North Coast. Evaluate regional specific adaptations to anticipate climate impacts. Engage community members, technical specialists, tribal members in the development of the report. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And then mitigation, how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are really in other reports. Our report was really focused not on how are we mitigating. They also asked us not to put out recommendations necessarily. So we do have information about how to create resiliency in our region in our report, but we were specifically asked not to give recommendations. So the process is that we met for years as our lead team. There are 6 of us, as I mentioned before, for about 2 years. We were asked to develop engagement, and so we reached out to develop throughout the 6 counties to develop a community advisory board, and we also had a technical advisory board. We held Zoom meetings periodically over this time period with these advisory boards. We also held a summit that was a very useful and productive summit that we had in Arcata to design the scope, develop, and revise the report. So hear from the community and technical advisory, not just from the lead authors. And develop data products within this. We also developed worked with the statewide climatology team So there's consistency in the climate data and climate projections across all regions and the reports. We also had external reviewers, and there's also a review by the governor's office. So we had lead authors, we had many advisory board members, and we had many section authors that input. We received input from also from a statewide tribal advisory group, and we allowed multiple times during this process of writing the report to hear from all of these individuals. And at the current state of where the report is it's sitting what we think is in the final editor's review, and we should be hearing any day about any minor things that we need to complete. So just to, I know this really small font, but I just want to emphasize that this was a group effort. We really felt that it was important to hear from individuals, and of course it's not comprehensive in that it isn't representing everyone in the North Coast region, but we really tried to reach out. So we have 42 contributing authors, 20 advisory board members, the land use and climate innovation staff from the governor's office. There was an associated editor. There were peer reviews. We spent a lot of time trying to reach out to the different counties. So we either met with boards of supervisors or individual supervisors or their staff in each county. We heard from other members. We tried to attend meetings and give an overview of what we're trying to do, and then also provide, get feedback at various meetings that occurred over this time period in the region, including, for example, we went to the North Coast Resource Partnership, thank you. And there was a Humboldt Bay Symposium and various events that we participated in. Okay, Andy.
All right, so I'm going to talk about the Chapter 1, Climate Science and Physical Changes, kind of just a big overview. Next slide. So the major variable that's going to be driving change in our world is temperatures increasing. And so for Humboldt County, we've seen a steady increase since 1900, you know, with some variations, El Nino cycles. So this is showing anomalies. So if it's blue, it's below the 1981 to 2010 average. And if it's red, it's above that. One of the things that stands out to me is that you've got about 1.5 degrees rise from 1900 to 2000. And then you have a full 2 degrees rise just in the last 10, 15 years. So this idea of possible acceleration. Certainly, we've seen a lot of warming in our region in very recently. Precipitation is not as clear of a trend. Interestingly, right now we're kind of in a dry period if you look at the last couple of years, but it's not more extreme than a dry period that we saw, say, in the early part of the 20th century. You can see sort of a long, several decade dip back there. Next slide. So we've got future predictions from global climate models of kind of where this is going to go. And these are downscaled to be reflective of our region. So you can see if we're around, you know, say 51 degrees in 2010, in the worst case scenario, we would see another 10 degrees of warming by the end of the century. I would add as a side comment that currently we're headed towards the higher emission scenario if you look at certainly governmental action at the federal level. Precipitation, you see not a lot of change, at least in terms of annual totals. More on that. Next slide. One of the things that's interesting is the changes are distributed differently over the year. So we're seeing hotter summers. So more of that increase is going to be happening in the times of year when it's already hot. So that's an important distinction to make. And then if you look at precipitation, we're going to see what's called seasonal sharpening. So the times of year when we already get a lot of rain, December, January, February, we're going to see increases in rain, you know, up to 20% more rainfall. And then the shoulder seasons, such as the spring, are going to be getting drier, so 20 to 30% drier. And so you can really think through, there's a lot of implications there for things like water supply in the driest part of the year and fire conditions, so longer fire seasons and worse fire weather that we've already been observing. Next slide. Rainfall intensity will increase. So if you look at the rainiest day of the year in inches per day, this chart A is showing a historical period, 1981 to 2010. You can see how rainy it is in Del Norte, you know, with 7 inches falling in a day. And then you can see the changes. So generally that we're seeing greens and darker greens. So we're seeing by mid-century and then late century increases in the rainiest day of the year. And so that what that means is flooding, right? So that's going to make our floods worse and more intense. It's going to increase the amount of water that our infrastructure has to deal with in a short time period. So maybe that means the gutter on your roof starts flooding down the side of your house when it never did before, or the sewers are backing up, or the storm sewers. Yeah. Next slide. Interestingly, you know, you might say, well, if our rainfall's not changing, how come we're seeing more drought, right? So this is a prediction of extreme drought increase. So this would be for over a 1-year drought and a 3-year drought is number C, letter C. And the way this is calculated is they're looking at a drought that had a 5% chance of occurring in a given year. And so if we see a region that's now light pink, say 10 to 15%, that means that drought is now twice to three times more likely to occur than in the historic record. This here is looking at, let me check. This is mid-century, so that's 2040 to 2070. So that's, you know, 2040 is not that far away. Okay, next slide. I guess we gotta move quick here. So thinking about sea level rise, we've got three tidal stations, Crescent City, North Spit, and Arena Cove, that we looked at data for. Next slide. The Humboldt County, North Spit, is really an epicenter across the western United States for sea level rise because of the tectonics, the ground is sinking. And we've been seeing these pulses. So this is the historical record, 1975 to 2025. You can see during that time period, we've already seen a foot of sea level rise, right? This is not something that's happening in the future. This is something that's already upon us. The other thing that's a little chilling for our area is that we've got these pulses where the sea level rises quickly. So the red lines, it's rising 5 inches in a decade. And if you notice that we just concluded a blue line. So we're now immediately due for seeing 5 to 6 inches of sea level rise over the next decade if this pattern carries on. Globally, the rate of sea level rise has been accelerating. Next slide. This is showing some of the predictions of how sea level will rise. Again, it's dependent on the rate of emissions. The choices that we make today will influence which of these lines we're on 20 years from now. And so you can see, if we look at the worst case rise, that's another 10 inches in the next 20 years, 25 years. Yeah. So let's not do that. let's see, next slide. This is back to Rosemary.
Okay, so we're kind of tag teaming different sections. So the natural land and water component, these were components that the state, all the regional reports have. So all of the information goes into these sections. So just to point that out. One of the things that we felt was very important was to represent tribal perspectives. So we have lead authors, other authors, technical advisory board members, community advisory board members that gave us feedback and contributed to this report. So we have emphasized in this report throughout the sections that we need collaborative approaches. Traditional ecological knowledges are intergenerational place-based knowledges built on observation, ceremony, and adaptive practices that enhance biodiversity, among other things. And we emphasize co-stewardship, so not just cooperation. And there are great models in our region, ongoing, currently, and from the tribes that we emphasize in this report for thinking about indigenous management practices and shared stewardship. I'm going to talk a little bit about, and there's these next slides are a little wordy, but we're trying to hit some of the highlights. The climate impacts on rivers and lakes, what we know is that what Andy just presented is that we're going to see hotter temperatures. We're going to be seeing reduced water inputs. That means from greater climate water deficits. But at the same time, as Andy was mentioning, these more rainy days in a shorter period of time are going to lead to more flooding as well. And that also leads to longer dry periods. So during periods of low flow, we expect to see reduced dissolved oxygen levels and higher water temperatures. In lakes, we expect to see greater stratification, which could lead to reduced oxygen in deep water and impact cold water fish. I'm going to have the hydrologist talk more about this section here. So go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, so this is looking at what are some things we can think about to increase the climate resilience of our rivers and lakes. One thing is really protecting and maintaining our headwater streams. So forested headwater streams support summer flows and also protecting larger spring-fed streams from land use disturbance. Thinking about estuarine habitat for juvenile salmon, we're going to be having worse floods. And so having estuaries where that are essentially refugia for fish during high flood is important. Those also, if we have droughtier conditions and faster flow recessions in the summer, then those estuary habitats will become even more important. So I was thinking about Didi Damo's discussion of people not reporting their diversions of water or groundwater plans that had not been updated. So that sort of plays off this comment here. It's important that we enforce regulation of diversions and that we monitor how much groundwater is being pumped out of landscapes and that's super important. Off-channel habitat as refugia for high flows and to support fish species. Increasing streamside vegetation throughout the watershed will shade and cool rivers, so bringing back riparian forest. Beaver reintroduction, like that's a great example of a climate adaptation. Dams can be released to release more cold water, or dams can be taken down. So here's the Potter Valley Dam. Removing that dam will open up hundreds of miles of cold water refugia for fish. Investigating the potential to thin forests or bring back more prescribed fire to have, as they say, fewer straws on the landscape, sucking up water, that has potential. The more we can preserve healthy populations, the more of fish and the more we preserve life history diversity and genetic diversity, and that will increase resilience in the future. And then reducing non-native fish and the pressures from that. I was asked, or we were asked in the comments to say a few things about water quality specifically, and we didn't have time to make a slide about that, but I wanted to give a couple comments there. One is if you think about flooding, that is the worst water quality, right? When you get a flood, that's when the rivers turn just brown with mud, and they're also often full of bacteria. And so, thinking about a future with more floods, that means more low quality water in rivers and also in lakes and reservoirs, because all of that storm water is washing into the lakes. They're already seeing in New England, which has had accelerating rainfall intensity beyond what we've seen here so far, declines in turbidity of lakes, or sorry, increases of turbidity in lakes across the region. You also have more. So the septic systems, right? So with more groundwater, more water moving in through the system, you can overwhelm septic systems and get more bacteria flooding into water. So more beach closures, more bacterial issues should be expected. You're also going to see more erosion, sediment from dirt roads, road cuts. You're going to see more landslides. The landscape is going to come apart a lot more than it is already doing in our region. And then thinking about urban environments, more intense rainfall means more urban runoff with oil, crankcase oil, tire grit, bacteria, things like that, trash washed into bays and rivers. On the other side, thinking about water quality is drought, increasing algal blooms, from low flows and concentration of nutrients, temperature spikes. So we're really seeing the worst of the dry conditions and the flooding. I think the solutions and the resilience comes from good watershed management. We already know what to do. The tools are the same. It's just more urgent that they're applied, getting ahead of it. You know, whether that be inspecting cars and their crankcases, sweeping streets, riparian buffers, floodplain and marsh reclamation, all those things that I mentioned for resilience. Back to you, Rosemary.
Okay, this is a little hard to read, but some of our scientists were able to look at, you know, what's happening on the shoreline. So the diagram to the left and then in the middle are showing projected shoreline changes in meters with sea level rise, so SLR, sea level rise. And the one in the middle shows with 20-year storms. So the colors, if we just focus on that, what we see is that there's going to be variation, right, across the region, across the shorelines. I should say the third diagram is projected cliff change. And so there is a mean value towards the upper right in each one of those that shows, for example, minus 29 meters for just sea level rise projected shoreline change. So what I wanted to just emphasize is that we know there's going to be a lot of shoreline decrease and as well as cliff changes, but it is variable across the regional area. One of the things that we were able to put into the report is also is there's already observed shoreline retreat. So this is Elk River Spit over a period of time. And the records show from that we're recording imagery from 2009 to 2018. There's 2018 in the far left diagram, show this freshwater lagoon area that no change in the actual size of the spit. And then there were some major tides, king tides, and then also some human-induced changes that occurred in 2018. And then there seems to be rapid change after that. So here, this third image is on the right is showing 2023, and you can see significant change that's already occurred. So, you know, it's here now. We know this is a pretty depressing story. We'll talk about some of what we know we're already doing that as Humboldt and other counties in the North Coast are models for thinking about climate resiliency. So climate resiliency for our oceans and coastal habitats, first of all, when we think about our oceans, it's really global factors that are contributing greenhouse gases and warming. But we have a lot that we have the capacity to do and already are doing in our North Coast region. We strongly emphasize in this report nature-based solutions. So, for example, buildup of berms to create salt marshes to deal with the attenuation of waves while also creating productive habitat and recreational areas as we think about the locations between Arcata and Eureka, for example. Reclaim tidal lands through dike breaching and recontouring poor quality agricultural lands. We want to emphasize what is already being done and then emphasize that these are methods that work and we should be doing this more. Reducing other stressors, habitat loss to development, buffering agricultural and urban runoff, as Andy was mentioning a little bit about earlier, maintaining some of our well-managed fisheries, supporting fisheries transitions, and then our networks of marine protected areas. And then manage, you know, our coastal habitats in concert with what's happening inland in our watershed. So freshwater and terrestrial conditions are really strong drivers of what's happening along our coastal habitats. And we also have a terrestrial component that's very important in the report, but I know based on time, I'm just gonna hit a couple of highlights here because this is a presentation for the Water Board. We emphasize our terrestrial systems are, as well as our water systems, our ecological insurance and our important cultural heritage. We have incredible biodiversity, productivity, and carbon sequestration in our terrestrial systems. What has been doing in this region, and we were really inspired by looking into all of the things that are happening in our region, is we really are a model for adaptive management, and we want to emphasize that. For example, the Klamath Dam removal. This is one of the only regions that our rangeland scientists say can really have sustainable livestock production. There's co-stewardship and collaborative management. The cultural burning and indigenous stewardship in our region is really a model. We want to emphasize that we want to manage for long-term resilience. You know, thinking about fire, habitat restoration in culturally important species. We have refugia for climate as climate changes in our region. And we emphasize a lot of case studies. So I want to sort of emphasize that. This is about a 100-page report with 100 pages of an appendix. And a lot of the detail is really in the appendix because we have so many case studies to shine and show about our region. And then, you know, there's a list of long concerns about climate change, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, that are important. And that's part of the responsibility of this report is to emphasize what is key for our region. Andy.
Okay, so I'll talk about built systems. Next slide. So we're looking at six counties, 380,000 residents spread across 19,000 square miles. So single highway corridor, single source power lines and water systems with no secondary supply. So in 2022-23, we had 9 storms in 3 weeks. Power was cut to 200,000 homes. It disabled communications, contaminated water supplies, and closed multiple access routes simultaneously. So a key point of this chapter is this idea of cascading failures. When the power goes out, the water pumps fail. When the roads close, the fuel can't reach backup generators. If backup generators are down, 911 doesn't work. So one failure triggers the next. And this can have a real crisis, particularly for people on powered medical equipment or needing refrigerated medications. Next slide. So some suggestions, developing state guidance that allows water agencies to build climate reserves under Prop 218. So the current rules make it structurally difficult to save money for future upgrades or future projects. Classifying distributed resilient systems such as microgrids or small water partnerships as essential infrastructure would make them more eligible for shared financing. expanding program eligibility to include nature-based and integrated approaches with demonstrated performance records, such as cultural burning, bioengineered slopes, constructed wetlands. These have decades of proof of being work that they work, but they remain outside most conventional funding categories. Multi-year funding commitments will allow regional coordination to build capacity and allow it to persist between grant cycles. So short grant cycles disperse the expertise that communities need. We have a case study from Dunsmuir about this. Insurance frameworks that recognize fire-resistant retrofits or nature-based risk reduction in the premium calculations. This is a way to incentivize communities to make these investments. The state insurance plan, the FAIR plan, went from $112 billion in coverage to $724 billion in coverage in 6 years because of private insurers pulling out of the market. So this is a major issue for rural areas that people are unable to get insurance for their properties. Next slide.
Okay.
Back to Rosemary.
So, you know, we're sharing a lot and some of the highlights, but importantly, we need to think about our social systems. So one of the key things that we're emphasizing is our area is the climate risk is really structurally driven. So we have inequities, legacies of inequities, very rural environment. So we have legacies, obviously, of colonization, extractive economies, among other things, high poverty, unemployment, unaffordable housing, and health disparities, and also pollution. And some of that pollution isn't necessarily recognized. So for example, some of the effects of wildfire isn't always recognized in the health pollution, for example. This diagram is a little bit fuzzy, but basically it shows disadvantaged communities. And so those are the in yellow are disadvantaged, and then in orange are severely disadvantaged. So basically most of the region, right, fits into this category. And that one of the emphasis is that, you know, state policies don't always fit very well with rural and environments, right? So it doesn't always make sense. So rural and tribal conditions are very different from urban frameworks, and some of the state policies often are thinking about larger populations in those urban environments. We have very high remoteness, smaller governments, you all know this, limited staffing, and so on. But we also emphasize, again, the strong strengths that we have in the region. So we have strong community networks because of some of the lack of support. And we have strong tribal leadership. And so indigenous-led restoration and government models that we want to share with the state as working and important climate resiliency models. As I mentioned, you know, we emphasize in the report solutions, and so we strongly emphasize indigenous leadership and stewardship, and there are some examples. Emphasizing regional governance and collaboration, so the North Coast Resource Partnership is a really excellent example. We use a number of other examples in the report. We have workforce and economic strategies, this term ecological uplift, thinking about restoration as also employment. And thinking about community-based resiliency, we have some really excellent examples of tribal-led and other community disaster responses, innovative finance approaches, blending funding, say private sources and community, because of the lack of ability to get funding through other mainstream sources. One thing that we also emphasize is that the vulnerability metrics don't actually measure how vulnerable our populations are. We need to have new tools and supporting other metrics that go into these. And then we really emphasize strongly investing in regional collaboration rather than state level. Andy.
Okay, so I'll summarize a few things. I wanted to point out from what Rosemary was talking about with the vulnerability, it's the wildfire smoke. So when we have wildfire in our region, many people are exposed to really bad air quality conditions. But if you look on a given day, our air quality is much better than, say, Los Angeles. So we don't. So that doesn't come out in the metric. Okay. So key takeaways: thinking about cascading and compounding impacts is really important to try to think through the sequence of events. What it really means if the power goes out for extended time, for example. The fact that we're kind of the canary in the coal mine for sea level rise, we are already seeing changes that might not take, that may be decades away for other parts of California. Need to protect climate refugia, aquatic and terrestrial habitats that will sustain populations as the climate warms. Planning for adaptation and thinking about restoration and conservation are ecological insurance. And we have in our region, that makes us wealthy. We have a lot of ecological insurance. The North Coast is under-resourced historically, but has strong community networks and tribal knowledge. And then thinking about nature-based solutions have multiple benefits and help us adapt to these impacts. With funding, we can become a leader in climate adaptation in our region. Next slide. So we have an event we want you to know about. October 20th to 22nd is the Resilient California Summit, where all of the different regions will be presenting their reports, as well as the other reports that go into this fifth climate assessment. So looking forward to that. Next slide. I have just a couple of minutes to take questions, but Rosemary will stay, and Matt St. John, who's contributed a lot to this report, can also take questions or give the questions to me, and I'll give answer or give you written answers later.
Thank you so much, board members. Do we have any questions, comments for the presenters?
It's hard to sit up here and digest so much deep information and respond immediately. So I just to say, you know, thank you for doing this. I'm stalling here so I can come up with some questions, you can see. It's on one hand, it's depressing. I'm struck by, you know, even though we think our region is the center of the universe, it's not. These are globally driven impacts. We can provide leadership if others will follow. And so I think the power of this regional report will go with the other eight, and hopefully someone in California can then take it to a global climate network and show by example. Obviously, our little region is not driving climate change, and so even though all of the wonderful things we can do, we need help, right? We need global help to do this. And I'm frustrated with the climate deniers that are in power and just want to bury it under the rug, you know, and their ignorance is part of the problems driving this. So thank you for a very depressing report.
I know.
But we did our job then.
He knocked it out of the park, buddy. But anyway, it's, you know, I mean, I'm a geek. I eat this stuff up, and it's sound science. You both articulated very well, and you know, and thank you for sharing with us today. It was really, I was looking forward to this, and you didn't disappoint. So thank you.
Thank you. I just want to, I'll be real brief. I know this was, it's too much to digest. It's also depressing, but we really in the report emphasize what we're already doing in the North Coast, and that isn't just us. We're putting it into the document. And one thing that we have that's really important is we took this on because we knew that we needed to write this in our region. It was not written from someone in our region, not to say he's a bad guy or anything last time it was written, but and so we really believe we're bringing in voices. It's not a complete picture of everybody's voice, but we think that's important, and the state recognizes that. So I think it will have an impact for our region. We're very hopeful.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the depth of this report. I was glad that you had mentioned the North Coast Resource Partnership. It was a supervisor from here in Humboldt County, Jimmy Smith, who basically led to the creation of what was then known as the North Coast IRWIMP, Integrated Regional Water Management Program, which then changed its name to the Resource Partnership. But what came out of that was a collaboration between the tribal entities and the counties of this region. Now, why Sonoma County was left out of your report, that wasn't for me to say. I find it strange, but I'm assuming that Sonoma County was bundled in with the nine Bay Area counties and not the Region 2 part.
So there's central there's a central coast report, and then there's a Bay Area report.
Yeah.
So I wish we would have shown the whole map of the different regions, and that was really driven by the governor's office.
But the thing to remember about the North Coast Resource Partnership is that with a leadership council with voting members from tribes and from the boards of supervisors was responsible for distribution of proposition dollars to projects throughout this region. I've never quite been able to track what the hell's going on with Proposition 4 distribution of monies, but it seems to me that and I'm a wee bit more optimistic than my colleague to my left, that in fact there are organizations in place, and it'll come back to the money. Will there be money to, you know, implement what you are have exposed and presented? So thank you for the report, and I remain an optimist.
My question is, you mentioned, I think, that you gave us predictions, but you weren't allowed to give recommendations. Is that when you guys collaborate from the state level, is there going to be recommendations coming out?
Yeah, so we, in our first draft, had policy recommendations, and the reviews from the state where this isn't a policy document. We don't want you to do that, but we hope to create a group that will put together policy recommendations from this entire report. To be honest, we did just reword things, and so there are policy recommendations in there. We just took out those key words, and so we tried to keep a lot of our ideas in there from everyone collectively. What are the things? So, for example, nature-based solutions. What we're already doing, and is it models?
And my other question is, with recommendations possibly coming forward, could this impact like funding sources if we're recategorizing this region?
That's the idea, is that we put this report together, and it's just one of many for California, right? Where we put the state and the project, you know, state of where we are, the projections, and what are already solutions that are ongoing. And those then are seen by policymakers that then support funding for different components. That's the goal.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the presentation. It's really great. I like Greg, I'm kind of, there's a lot here to digest and something to kind of, what did catch my eye very specifically, there was a slide, the sea level rise, north split sea levels, your beautiful graph that you have here. And what I was struck by, was sort of the alternating results per, you know, 8 to 9 year groupings that you have. And my day job, I'm a real estate appraiser, and I do a lot of pistachio orchards, and pistachios are an alternate bearing crop. So one year you're going to have a huge production, you know, 5,000 pounds an acre, and then the next year you're going to have like nothing. Mm-hmm. And the following year, another 5,000. So we call it alternate bearing. And looking at these results, it caught me. I said, wow, look at that. We have 0.9 inches per DEC, whatever that stands for, 1 year, and then the next year it was 5 inches. And then the next year we were back down to 0.3. Following year back up to 5. So I found that alternating, and I maybe there's, you don't have a reason, or maybe there is no explanation for that or what, but I just found that really peculiar. And just again, this will be cool. I can't wait to see the full report and it's when it's published.
Yeah, just to emphasize a little bit on that, and I know this has been a long presentation. That part was written by two of our local scientists, and they believe that the data they have collected regionally is a better representation than what the state puts out. So we are putting that out from that in that as new and updated, right, for our region, because the North Spit is increasing so rapidly, or already has. That decadal or multi-decadal shift, if you wanted to predict, it's related, they say, you know, the Pacific decadal oscillation. So we have El Nino, Southern Oscillation, right, shifting, but we also have these longer-term decadal periods of warmer, cool, or drier, wet periods driven by the Pacific decadal oscillation. So they really tie that, those periods, to those shifts in, mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So thank you so much. I don't really have a question so much as just that observation. So thank you.
I'd like to comment. Thank you for your work, and I think this is important, and for most especially for planning and prioritizing investment by the government to help build out infrastructure and protect existing and modify existing infrastructure to for the benefit of the public and the environment. And it's a huge challenge. Just trying to wade through everything you presented. Very good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one question. So putting together your presentation and then listening to Dee Dee Adamo's presentation, I was struck by the schizophrenic position that the state of California is expressing right now. We've got the Klamath Dams coming down. People want to take down the Scott Dam on the Eel, and yet we're talking about building the Sites Reservoir, and there's a whole group of people that are saying we need to establish more water storage. Sites is going to be somewhat unique if it works. They're going to pump water out at high flows from the sack and pump it uphill to fill that hole. But, you know, so we have these combatants out there of people, big money pushing for more water, big money pushing for less dams and less reservoirs. I think your information will help serve the decisions of if more water storage is constructed, how is it done in the least environmentally insensitive way, right? And I think looking ahead and projecting how this kind of information can still meet the overwhelming needs of Californians, but at the same time doing it in a minimal way that doesn't cause some of the legacy issues that we've seen with other water impoundments. So just 2 cents. I was just struck by one presentation saying they're pushing to build more water and then us all recognizing the dams have created some real legacy issues. So just
yeah,
sharing.
And I appreciate that context. I do. We're kind of been locked in this report. And just one more comment that I felt in this kind of dire federal situation of the current administration, the Trump administration, we felt like we were able to pull this together and had very good support from the state to do so. So it's sort of like, I know it's a doom, you know, it's not a very positive topic, but we felt like we had a lot of support from the state.
Madam. I just want to make a comment. I don't have a question, but I really appreciate the TEK stamp that I see all over this and the collaboration that is very clearly you've been collaborating with the tribes in the region. I think we are uniquely qualified to help teach the world how to fix this problem. So I feel very strongly that if we're going to save the world, we're going to have to lean towards TEK. So thank you for including it.
Well, we try to emphasize that. We know we underwhelmed that. You know, it's a hard thing to represent everybody's perspective, but we tried our best. So thank you for that comment.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Is it okay with you if I provide a bit of staff perspective?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank okay. you.
Thank you. So I didn't preview this presentation before it happened, so it was I was listening as intently as all of you. And some of the things that struck me was, of course, anytime we hear information like this about climate change, there's a lot of bad news. But it also really struck me that the good news is so many of these recommendations are things that are within the purview of this board and things that this board has already been advancing and supporting and leading, within the state. And so, I thought about our temperature policy, which really supports protecting and improving riparian canopy. And, we think we heard a lot about riparian canopy as an important element of protecting surface water bodies. Our restoration policy, which supports, short-term water quality impacts for the larger long-term benefit of a restoration project. And, we heard about restoration as ecological insurance. You heard from our restoration specialist in February that we're a leader in the state in terms of supporting restoration projects. Depending on the time period you're talking about, our region issues 40 to 50% of the permits in the state for restoration projects. So North Coast is leading, and that's certainly not just the regional board. That's also all of the organizations that are bringing forward restoration projects to us. So, I also really appreciated the note about how sometimes statewide policies don't necessarily fit a rural landscape. And so that's another thing that our staff work on regularly is providing comments either formally or informally into state board processes to advocate for policies, especially policies related to funding, to advocate that those policies really fit the landscape of the North Coast region rather than just focusing on what's needed in urban environments. Another, we heard about shoreline adaptation and nature-based solutions, and I just want to, highlight that Matt St. John, our climate specialist, is working, especially in Humboldt Bay, working really deeply with local governments and tribes to try to advance planning for shoreline adaptation solutions in Humboldt Bay. And then lastly, I just wanted to highlight, that Matt, as our climate specialist, has been very engaged with this regional report process for the fifth climate assessment, and also was responsible for bringing this presentation to you today. So I know that board members are often interested to hear what our climate specialist is up to, and so just highlighting that that this is part of it and that this effort really dovetails with so much of the other work that Matt is doing. So I think that's all the comments I have, and I also just want to see if Matt has any other comments that he'd like to provide. And I hope I didn't steal your thunder, Matt.
It's good thunder. Hi, members of the board. Welcome to the newest board members. My name is Matt St. John. I'm an environmental program manager, and I'm the climate specialist for the North Coast region. And Rosemary and Andy did a great job giving their report. As I was on the technical advisory board, advising in the development of the report. A couple of additional points to the ones that Valerie made. One of the things that was highlighted was the importance of protecting refugial habitat. And one of the projects that you'll be hearing more about is, sorry. It's funny, I used to talk to the board so often, and now I get nervous. one of the projects that we're working on is using one of the authorities out of the Federal Clean Water Act to designate waters as outstanding national resource waters. And you'll be hearing more about that project over the coming months. We'll have a written report for the June board meeting. But one of the reasons that I thought that that was an important project to take on is because it provides a legal and regulatory protection for waters that are designated. And so it's a way of protecting climate refugia. So that's something that you'll hear more about in the next, over the next year. And then on, with regard to sea level rise in Humboldt Bay, just to say, as Valerie mentioned, that's one of the kind of geographic focal areas of my work. And so I'm Rosemary and Andy have a colleague at Cal Poly Humboldt, Dr. Lori Richmond, who's the co-chair of the Sea Level Rise Institute. And I'm on the leadership committee for that Sea Level Rise Institute. And as mentioned, we're working with the local jurisdictions around Humboldt Bay to do some collaborative cross-jurisdictional planning with regard to sea level rise adaptation and trying to promote use of nature-based solutions to adapt to the risks of sea level rise in and around Humboldt Bay. So that too is another initiative that you'll hear about in time. And then the third thing I would say is one of the things that we do as an agency is providing technical and policy support, as well as advocating for funding for local jurisdictions. In our many of our NPDES permits, we include requirements for local jurisdictions to do the necessary planning to be able to respond to extreme weather events, you know, flooding events. So that's kind of on the planning protection or preventative side. But then when there is an extreme weather event, you know, and there are, Andy mentioned these cascading of effects of when there's, you know, extreme storms that impact, cause, you know, sewer spills and things like that. Our staff then are working with the local jurisdictions to, you know, minimize those impacts when there is damage. So that's just an example of both how we're building in climate resilience planning into our permits, and then on a response side, providing support to the local jurisdictions to respond following an extreme weather event or fire. And then as one of the concluding points that Andy made, the slide, is that one of the reasons that I thought that the fifth climate assessment and the North Coast Synthesis Report was a worthwhile effort to really put some time into is to elevate and the fact that the North Coast region has so much capacity for climate resilience just based on, you know, local, you know, the Mediterranean climate, but then on the kind of natural and working lands, that there's kind of built-in ecological insurance, but that we're in an underfunded region. It's a disadvantaged region, and we're underfunded. So we want to use this report to elevate the opportunities and the needs for statewide funding. Really, that's my last point, is how we can leverage this report for additional funding for the region.
Madam Chair, so, Matt, when you decided to make your change, you convinced this board that you wanted to go into the direction of developing a climate resilience program for the agency. And at the time, you know, you shared with me you didn't have a firm grasp of what it was going to look like. But it's obvious that in a very short time, you've got your legs under you and have developed, it's not a surprise, but developed yourself into a leading expert for this agency. And I want this board to know that you started with nothing. You know, you even moved your desk. I mean, you had nothing. And I want to congratulate you on what you've done in such a short time. So you've done a hell of a job. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And I think Valerie's doing a hell of a job, too.
I also want to recognize you, Matt, and your work. And you had already started, the North Coast had already begun projects, and you incorporated them into your climate change, your climate resilience department, and I thought that was brilliant.
Well, thank you, Hector. Yeah, great. Well, lots more to come. It is sometimes depressing, but at the same time, the region and the North Coast Regional Water Board are doing exciting work in this regard, and so it's an evolving story.
Yeah, and as ever, I know this region, we lead and forge our own paths and kind of ask for forgiveness versus permission sometimes, and I'm completely fine with that because I think we're really setting a great example for not only the rest of the state but maybe other regions that could pick up some out-of-the-box ideas on how to approach these working landscapes. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just remind everybody that this fall there will be the Resilient California Summit, and what we have just heard from our presenters this morning will be part of reports from all of the regions of the state of California. It's scheduled to be a 3-day event in Sacramento, and they believe that action will, in fact, come out of this summit meeting. So, Madam Chair and Madam Executive Officer and Matt, I look forward to participating in this summit, and I think that the work that you've been doing and the work that our reporters were doing will obviously be part of that conference and part of the deliberations. So thank you very much.
Emma, I just want to double check if we received any interest from the public on this agenda item.
Not on this agenda item.
Great. So with that, let's move on. Agenda item number 5 has been dropped, so we're moving. That's what we just there. We're going to do that at the end. We're moved it to the end. Unless there's a request from the board, do anyone need a break, or are we going to keep going?
Let's take a break.
Okay. We'll take a come back at 10:30. It is 10:17 right now. Come back at 10:30. Does that sound? Does that give everybody good? Okay. Good. Okay, it is 10:32, and we are starting back with agenda item number 6, update on removing receiving water limits from National Pollutant Discharge Elimination Systems, or NPDES, wastewater permits. This is the time and place for an informational item to discuss the update on receiving water limitations in National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, NPDES, permits. An impact of City and County of San Francisco v. EPA Supreme Court decision. The board will hear from staff and interested persons and may provide comment and direction to staff, but the board will take no formal action on this item. We will begin with a staff presentation followed by board discussion and comments from interested persons. Interested persons are generally limited to 5 minutes. Board member questions and comments, other than questions clarifying materials being presented, should be held until after the staff presentation or until there is a break in the presentation for questions. So let's go.
Great. Well, good morning, Chair Hart, members of the board, and a special welcome to our newest board member. It's great to have you. I'm Mona Doherty, and I supervise the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, wastewater permit program at the regional board. Today I'll be describing recent updates in the receiving water limits and NPDES permits, and I'll be joined by our counsel, Bailey Toft-Pui, who is going to speak directly to the Supreme Court decision and its impact on our permits. As we're discussing NPDES permits today, we'll be discussing discharges to surface waters and that fall under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. So today we'll start with some background on the NPDES wastewater program at the North Coast Board and receiving water limitations. Like I mentioned, Bailey will provide an overview of the City and County of San Francisco v. EPA decision, and then I'll finish with what this means for the NPDES wastewater permits. First, let's talk about the NPDES wastewater program at the North Coast Water Board. This is a program that was established by the Clean Water Act to regulate municipal.
Could you move your microphone closer?
Oh, closer? Okay.
So we can hear you a little better.
Okay. How's that? Okay. This is a program that, it sounds loud to me. Okay. This is a program that was established by the Clean Water Act and to regulate municipal and industrial discharges, point sources that discharge pollutants to waters of the United States. In California, the state and regional boards are authorized to implement this program. The permits include a variety of requirements to receiving to protect water quality and beneficial uses, including effluent limits, receiving water limits, discharge prohibitions, monitoring, and others. The permits are renewed on a 5-year schedule, or as close to that as we can. In our region, the NPDES wastewater program includes 34 individual permits and 4 regional general permits, and we also implement 9 state board general permits. All right, let's discuss receiving water limitations. NPDES permits included receiving water limitations to ensure water quality objectives are met in the receiving water. Receiving waters refers to the waters that receive the discharge of waste. In the NPDES program, these are surface waters such as oceans, bays, rivers, streams. And receiving water limitations are requirements that focus on the condition of the water body receiving the discharge rather than on the discharge itself. They are derived from both numeric and narrative water quality objectives established in the Ocean Plan, the Basin Plan, and the Statewide Water Quality Control Plan for inland surface waters, enclosed bays, and estuaries. Effluent limitations, in contrast, with receiving water limitations, are defined as restrictions on the quantities, rates, and concentrations of chemical, biological, physical, and other constituents, and are more commonly understood as limiting the discharge itself. Now Bailey will discuss the Supreme Court decision.
Thank you, Mona. Good morning, Bailey Taftapui with Office of Chief Counsel. Nice to see you all. So in 2019, US EPA and the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board jointly issued an NPDES permit for the City and County of San Francisco's combined treatment facility that discharges to the Pacific Ocean. In addition to other requirements in the permit, San Francisco's permit contained 2 receiving water limitations. The first prohibited the facility from causing or contributing to a violation of any applicable water quality standard. The second prohibited any discharge that creates pollution, contamination, or nuisance as defined under the California Water Code. San Francisco challenged these provisions, which ultimately made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In its decision, the Supreme Court considered whether Section 301 of the Clean Water Act allows receiving water limitations in NPDES permits. In particular, San Francisco argued that Section 301 of the Clean Water Act does not authorize EPA to impose NPDES permit requirements that condition permit holders' compliance on whether receiving waters meet applicable water quality standards. On March 4, 2025, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled in favor of San Francisco and held that Section 301 of the Clean Water Act does not authorize
end result provisions or receiving water limitations in NPDES permits. And the court used this phrasing, end result requirements, and I use that synonymously with receiving water limitations. End result requirements, as defined by the court, are those provisions that do not spell out what a permittee must do or refrain from doing. Rather, they make a permittee responsible for the quality of the water in the body of water into which the permittee discharges pollutants. In deciding the case, the court focused on the text of the Clean Water Act, including how to define the term limitation under Section 301, as well as the structure of the act and its legislative history. On one end, the court noted that a provision setting out specific rules a permittee must follow in order to achieve a certain degree of water quality would fall under the scope of Section 301. Conversely, when a provision simply tells a permittee that a particular end result must be achieved and that it is up to the permittee to figure out what it must do to comply with that permit provision, such provisions fall outside of Clean Water Act Section 301 authorization. The court ultimately concluded that end result requirements do not fall within the Clean Water Act Section 301. In the next slides, Mona will go over how the NPDES wastewater program has responded to this ruling. And in closing, I think it's just important to emphasize that this case concerned Clean Water Act authority. The court's decision did not interpret the California Water Code or the Water Board's permit authority thereunder. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may. Bailey, can you help me understand? It sounds like the court's decision does not put the onus on the discharger to protect water, that they're not held accountable for protecting the receiving water under the law.
The court and the majority opinion, they really focused on limitation as used under Section 301 and what the permit needs to spell out or not spell out to help a permittee understand what it needs to do at its facility, at its discharge point, before discharging to the receiving water. And so I think that was the tension. They really thought that there had to be those concrete, specific requirements in the permit so a permittee understood how to comply.
So in non-lawyer term, San Francisco has to clean up their water at their facility, and if they believe it's good enough to clean to discharge, they can discharge it.
Specific to this Section 301 and the authority for these provisions, and this was specific to EPA's permitting of the facility, that was the ruling from the majority. But again, that's not the regional board and our California Water Code authority that is supplemental to that.
So are you going to tell us how to resolve that conflict?
Mona is going to, in the next slides, talk about how we've responded, how we've altered the NPDES wastewater permits going forward.
I can't wait to hear.
And she probably won't use as lawyerly of terminology, so sorry about that.
Actually, that's why I asked Bailey to help me with the presentation, because the intricacy of the decision were such that I didn't feel comfortable presenting it to you all. So luckily, Bailey stepped in. So thank you, Bailey. All right. So what do we do with our permits now that we have this decision? So the first thing we had to do is we worked with the State Board Office of Chief Counsel, and we followed an approach that all the regional and state and the state board staff are going to follow. And the first part of that was to remove the receiving water limits from the permits that had been invalidated by the Supreme Court. Then we had to assess the receiving water limits that we were removing and determine whether there were protections elsewhere in the permits that protected beneficial uses. So we looked at what the receiving water limits were doing and tried to figure out if there was another tool that we could add to the permits or whether the permit was already adequately protecting beneficial uses in that area. So if the adequate protection was already there, we just removed the limit without replacement. Got a little trickier if we felt like there might be a little hole in protection of beneficial uses. And in that case, we would evaluate what we could add to the permit to protect there. So we looked at a combination of, I want to make sure I get all this right. In cases where existing requirements were not adequately protective, we added other tools to ensure water quality standards are met. These include end-of-pipe discharge prohibitions, for example, prohibiting the discharge of visible oil or grease, as well as specific effluent limitations, such as for settleable solids and turbidity. We also added additional monitoring in some cases, like nutrient monitoring, to evaluate potential impacts and determine whether a future effluent limit is needed. And special studies, such as for temperature and dissolved oxygen, that we would require to better understand the site-specific conditions of the receiving water and whether the discharge might impact negatively the receiving water in the areas of temperature and dissolved oxygen. And also I wanted to note this process is being done while we bring permits to you on the normal schedule. We are not opening up permits solely to remove the receiving water limitations. This is a process we're undertaking as we bring permits forward on their normal schedule. And why you're hearing from me today is that you're going to see the first permit that has had this process undertaken. That's item number 7, the the NPDES permit for the Talonicker Marine Lab that Cal Poly Humboldt is the discharger for that. So as Bailey noted, it's important to note what the decision does not change in our permits. The court did not address authorities under state law, so those remain intact. For example, discharge prohibitions related to pollution, contamination, or nuisance are still in place under state authority. Additionally, groundwater limitations remain unchanged since groundwater is regulated under state authority. The groundwater receiving water limitations you will still find in the permit. And those are continue to be applied based on basin plan objectives and recycled water standards. All right, so I am going to leave the presentation in. I wanted to show you guys some really beautiful photos that our staff has taken recently near our wastewater treatment plants. Some of our staff get to do inspections on these really gorgeous areas. So we have a photo here taken near the Mendocino City wastewater treatment plant and one taken near the Crescent City wastewater treatment plant. And so we are here if you have any further questions.
So I understand the change, but my question is if your limitations, the receiving waters, the size of the receiving waters, isn't that impacted by the discharge? And so how do they regulate this if you have a small amount body of receiving water? It seemed like the effluent would affect it differently depending on the size of the receiving waters.
Yeah, definitely. And that was some of the issue that we need to address site specifically. So when I talked about special studies, we worked with our temperature specialist, Brian McFadden, to look at the temperature impacts. For most of the water bodies that our permittees discharge to, the small amount of, discharge compared to the flow is not going to make there will be no discernible difference in temperature. However, there's one of our facilities that discharges to a really small stream. And it is temperature impaired. So that's where we need to have kind of more of a site-specific solution to see if additional either best management practices or additional treatments are needed there. So where we were not able to apply something kind of more to all the permits across the board, we put in some site-specific, or we're going to be putting in, we've been drafting the language, to site-specific special studies to evaluate. And dissolved oxygen is similar in that the impact to most water bodies from a wastewater discharge for dissolved oxygen is not going to be noticeable. However, there are some water bodies that could be impacted by this, and then we are going to look at it on a site-specific basis.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure I'm grasping this, to not use the legalese, but it seems to me, or it sounds like that the court is saying, hey, regulator, you can't, previously it was almost too broad. And so does the agency need to just give more specifics as to what the objectives are and how to go about it? And is that kind of what was going on? Or am I misunderstanding that?
I think I'll let Bailey take this one.
I think that was part of it, that the court wanted the burden to be more so on the agency to really spell out
what the objectives are,
how to comply with the objectives. So what the discharger, what do you need to do to not exceed objectives in the receiving water? So put the burden more so on the agency to really spell that out in the permit to make compliance clear and not leave the permittee to guess
or
be unsure if what they're doing is going to meet the end objective.
Okay.
The majority's death.
Okay. Thank you, Bailey.
And can I add to that? I think earlier Justy asked if this decision was releasing the discharger from the responsibility to meet or to protect receiving water quality. And correct me if I'm wrong, that's not what is occurring here. It's basically saying that, it's not saying that they should stop protecting water quality, but as Bailey was mentioning, it should just translate that water quality standard into more specific enforceable permit requirements so that they could understand what effluent limit, for example, would ultimately translate into a water quality protection in the receiving water.
They're actually giving the recipe to bake the cake, yes. Not just the ingredients.
Right.
Got it.
And before it would give us more flexibility, and now it's given us, I think my interpretation of it is given us a little bit less flexibility into that, but it's given them more direction, more clear, transparent direction as to how to go about meeting that water quality standard.
And I think that's totally right. And this, to emphasize too, the court was focusing on two of the receiving water limitations. There's a host of other permit requirements in there that are attempting to spell out have those specific requirements, have those effluent limitations. So the receiving water limitations in a lot of instances really served as a backstop mm-hmm. in addition to those specific requirements that were already there.
Well, thank you for adapting so quickly and rewriting these permits. So going forward, as permits expire, will you be doing the same to those that apply, or is this retroactive?
So we are already working on the language, and it's a bit different because we work under different authorities for inland surface waters and ocean dischargers. So we have the ones that are coming towards you in the next couple months are our ocean dischargers. So those ones we were working off of the ocean plan. And then, but we have been working on our inland surface water ones too to draft the language, and that's where we have more concerns about things like temperature, dissolved oxygen, nuisance conditions of harmful algal blooms, those kinds of things that we're evaluating in more detail. So you will be seeing those permits next fiscal year. Mm-hmm.
Just follow up on one comment from Hector is the court ruling is not retroactively effective. As Mona said, we're not going to be going back and reopening permits just to change these provisions. It's just forward looking.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So up here in Humboldt, there's ocean discharge. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, Shelter Cove discharges to the ocean. We have the Telonica Marine Lab. We also have DG Fairhaven, which is an inoperable right now power plant. But then a lot of our discharges, if you're thinking about like Eureka and Arcata, they discharge to Humboldt Bay, which is an enclosed bay, and it falls under a different authority, the state implementation policy for the inland surface waters, enclosed bays, and estuaries.
So do we have any ocean discharge permits in this region which are similar to the case that was brought by San Francisco, where they do discharge into the Pacific Ocean, as I recollect?
Yeah, you're actually going at the next meeting going to see a general order that we wrote for our ocean discharging publicly owned treatment works. So all throughout the coastline, we have Crescent City, we have Mendocino City, Anchor Bay, Fort Bragg. So we do have a variety of ocean discharging wastewater treatment plants, as well as industries like DG Fairhaven Power Plant.
And then when you've got an NPDES permit like Santa Rosa has for the subregional plant, which discharges into the Laguna de Santa Rosa and the Russian River, then is that a lower priority for us to review those permits?
Not a lower priority at all. we actually have another court decision that is working itself through the process that is challenging part of the toxicity provisions that the state board adopted. So that is being challenged in the courts right now, and that has caused an additional pause. So instead of the inland surface water permits, we've been primarily focusing on the ocean discharging permits while that case makes it through the court. But this next fiscal year, you will start seeing the inland surface water permits again.
So what courts is the toxicity decision being
that
going through, state or federal?
State. That is currently in front of the California Supreme Court.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
And may I add, Board Member McKenzie, to your question earlier about whether we have similar facilities to this particular City of San Francisco case in our region. And there are two nuances that are not similar. One is that it is a combined sewer system discharge of both stormwater and wastewater. And I do not believe we have that type of facilities here in our region. And also the discharge point for the City of San Francisco facility is 3 miles out of a discharge point, which means it's covered by USEPA as opposed to our state water board and PDS program. So USEPA covers that permit.
So it's outside of the boundary of the state. Authority ocean, the part of the ocean, and into the federal waters.
Thank you, guys.
Do I have any other comments from board members? Thank you so much for the presentation. Emma, I'm just double checking. Have we received any public comments on this specific agenda item?
No.
Great. Okay, with that, we're going to move on to our agenda item number 7, which is order number, public hearing on order number R1-2026-0014 to consider for adoption of proposed National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permit and Waste Discharge Requirements for the State, California State Polytech University Humboldt. Oh, I'm not going to pronounce that well. What's the name of their lab? How do you pronounce that?
Telonica
Marine Laboratory. This was scheduled as an uncontested item when the agenda was issued. If there are no comments from the permittee, public, board members, or staff, I will consider this an uncontested matter and proceed directly to a vote. Is there anyone present to comment upon this item. Do board members have any questions or comments? So I'll entertain a motion to adopt order number R1-2026-0014.
So move, Madam Chair.
Second.
And we'll have a roll call.
Board Member Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Romanini?
Aye.
Board Member Myers?
Huh.
Vice Chair McKenzie?
Aye.
Chair Hart?
Aye. Vote.
So sorry.
Yeah,
aye. Vote is unanimous.
Sorry. Okay.
And that passed unanimously.
Yes. So that concludes item number 7. And at this time, it's not on the agenda, but we have received just some general public comment requests. So I will allow those at this time. Emma, if you could call our first public commenter up.
Andy Colonna. Vivian Helwell, will you please come up?
Good morning, board, staff, officers. Thanks for your indulgence since we missed the early comment period, non-agenda. Did I say my name? Vivian Helliwell. Thank you. Commercial fishing background. And I want to ask what the proper procedure is for distributing information to the board, since there's no item up for a vote. And I have some pictures and
you can pass them to me, and our legal counsel will just take a look and make sure that there are no concerns with distributing it to the board, and then we'll pass it on to board members as appropriate.
That's great. I'll tell you about this. This is pictures, and these are public comments that we have made already to the state and regional board, especially for the chair today, because you said you like visual images. And one of these watershed management books for Officer Quinto. We had an extra one, thanks. So I just want to hold up this picture. I don't know if you can see it on the...
Vivian, why don't you just real quick give our counsel just a second, and they'll verify it, and then we'll let you continue on with your comment. Please, Emma, please.
Certainly. This is actually from our 2019 comments to this board.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about something else for a minute.
Okay.
This is a 28-inch... salmon pillow. And in commercial fishing, anything this length or shorter, we turn up the barbless hook and let them go to get bigger. This one here is a coho salmon in spawning colors. And you know, we sleep on these to dream of fishing. So
Vivian, we distributed the photos to the board. These comment documents, since there's only one copy of each, I'm going to scan them and email them to board members after the meeting so they have access to them.
That's great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And is it okay to show this picture to the camera? No. And this was in our 2019 comments. It's not a new picture. It's an old picture. It is a picture of, and I wonder if the crew can home in on it a little. I wasn't able to get a slideshow together today. This is a king tide aerial photo in 2019, and it shows the plume of mud from Elk River into the estuary. And so this is a reminder that the estuary is a nursery, the salmon passing through it, the mud will clog their gills. They can't smell as well. They can't see their food when they're young and they're going out, and when they're coming in, returning to the various rivers that feed into Humboldt Bay. I want to talk a little about my conversations with the residents who have been flooded 8 times this last winter in 3 inches of rain. And they have mainly given up trying to talk to this board because they don't see the results that they need. But we did encourage people to come and speak to you and speak into the record anyway for those who aren't aware of the history of that ongoing disaster for the people who live in the flooded area. One house can't be lived in anymore and can't get flood insurance at all because of that. And they tell me they're terrified when it rains because they can't get in and out to their homes. And as you heard yesterday from one of the residents, you know, the mud gets deeper and deeper on the fence posts, for example. This doesn't show improvement, as the stations on the river show, you know, things staying the same but not really improving or getting worse. But according to the residents, it's getting worse. More houses are flooded. FEMA has expanded the zone in which flood insurance is unaffordable for the people living there. And I just want to go over that again for a little emphasis, since the people themselves don't come here. And as was mentioned yesterday, when they did have a moratorium on logging, the flooding decreased. And now, you know, so I just want to ask the board to use whatever tools you can. You've been told by the staff that less logging won't make any difference in the amount of mud coming out. And restoration work is being done, and this is good. You know, some efforts are being made. It's not enough, and I'm not sure how much this board can do, but please use all the tools at your disposal to try to deal with this health and safety issue. Is that my 5 minutes?
That is your 5 minutes. But okay. Thank you so much for the visuals. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Fishing was fun. Wish we could keep doing it.
Next, we have Andy.
Hi, thanks for having us back. yesterday, after this meeting, I had a conversation with Jim Burke based on his comment, one of his comments in his presentation, that he didn't have a copy of this report that we handed to you, but he was looking for it and couldn't find it. And so I told him the reason why and handed him my other copy of this report, which he smiled at, and I showed him this picture that we got that was made on one of the areas that was in the report that you can read yourself about the history of this place. But here it is in 1975. This is 2 years before I first addressed this board on herbicide use in forestry, after this was all cut and they were spraying herbicides on the same watershed to release conifers that they had planted there by order of the state, you know, achieve stocking standards, and we're trying to push them to grow faster against the brush. And then it burned down in 83, just a year after the report was written. And I didn't bring any satellite imagery to show what it looked like in 1990, because, or aerial photos that we took after we flew it to look out the plane and snapshot what it really looked like after it had been hosed and burned and destroyed. But this is 1,000-year-old climax forest. And I have the same for 4 other quads, which includes Blue Creek and other drainages in the area that were really primo salmon habitat in the documents in this that you have now before you, if you really read this thing, we'll show you. So I just put one map that I made myself, this is years ago now, of the landslides. They also have, if you notice, soils, vegetation, timber harvest, and whether I can't remember right now, but landslides. And they explain what landslides are, how they work, and it's real detail. And we're going to supply those documents to you. I have them with me, but you don't have time for that today. So I'm going to read to you what it says on this report about. See, my problem is that I know the people who lived through this. And it, people like this lady here that just came on the board. I know her husband, too. I helped donate money to their campaign to get him to be elected to office to go into the state legislature to do this stuff, okay? So if you want to see a dynamic duo, I think you will before this is over. So I'm sorry, but my life has been a part of this thing. I get it. I get what their culture's about. I was an iron worker for several years. I worked with tribes all over the country. We're the guys that connected this stuff up on top. And I understand what's going on here and what's not going on here that should be. Here's what it says. In 1980, Turner Creek appears to be one of the streams in the reservation least impacted by logging activities. However, the area has been involved in a land transfer exchange for Redwood National Park and can be expected to be clear-cut in the near future. I mean, there's a lot more in here, but that's it. And it was. And we saw it happen. And we saw the results and the effects of those results. Well, we stopped being able to fish. Well, when timber production went way up in the 1980s, 4 years later, boom, we could see that the stocks were at the desperate levels, and there was a shutdown then, 1990, 91, 92. I was still able to commercially fish them, okay? So it really pissed me off to see this thing collapse on itself. And the regional boards and the state water boards allowed it to happen. Now we're appealing to the Scott River and the Shasta. They just went out to the state water board guys, went out there and took surveys like you guys were out there not that long ago in that area, Shackleford and so on. Notice there was no water in it? Why? The answer to that question, I can't, I don't have time. It would take longer than 5 minutes to explain it to you, but you get the idea. So now what? If the state water board staff is talking about bare minimum belly scraping, my words, flows to avoid extirpation, and the people in the area producing graphs that show their estimates are not even close to what the cubic feet per second needs to be. So it's over if we don't challenge that and win. And that's what one of these studies that we did, I made extensive comments on, and we'll show you. I hope you read this stuff. Because otherwise, I don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to have to raise the money and sue whoever the hell, however the hell we can do it to get our needs met. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We look forward to reading the report. Thank you.
Next, we have Ethan St. Clair.
Morning.
So, my name is Ethan St. Clair. I'm a Tallawa tribal member. I'm here to address the logical and scientific fallacies, current water management strategy for Smith River, and most likely many other rivers. Talk about the direct ongoing poisoning of our livelihood. The most dangerous fallacy is the claim that low levels of copper are safe. We are talking about living animals, Chinook, coho, and steelhead, that depend entirely on their olfactory system to survive. Peer-reviewed science confirms that trace amounts of dissolved copper, as low as 2 parts per billion, attack the olfactory neurons of these fish. It effectively blinds them. A salmon that cannot smell its way home is a salmon that cannot spawn. When you allow copper in the water, you are signing a death warrant for these species. This isn't a hypothetical risk. This is an ongoing leaching of neurotoxins from the lily bulb fields, and most likely many other corporations are directly polluting our creeks and our livelihood every time it rains. The logic behind vegetative buffers is failing. Recent data shows that water-soluble toxins like diuron is bypassing these filters entirely. This is a constant daily discharge of chemicals into a watershed that my people have protected for thousands of years. You are managing a slow motion disaster and calling it compliance. And I return to the most basic test of your leadership. Would any of you allow your own children or grandchildren to ingest these neurotoxins? If you wouldn't give this water to your family, you have no right to permit its discharge into ours. Our culture and our survival depend on the health of these living animals. And I'm just here to ensure that the destruction of the salmon's olfactory system and the poisoning of our community is not summarized away. And I expect a zero detection standard in the final August order for mainly the Lily Bell. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Before the possibility of getting into a board member discussion on this, I want to thank Mr. St. Clair for being here and commenting, and just note that because this is an item pending before the board that wasn't on the agenda, it wouldn't be appropriate to have a board discussion at this time, because there are others who are interested in the issue that may have tuned into the meeting if they felt that there was going to be a board discussion. So,
great.
Yeah, I'm sorry, was yesterday a better time, or was it?
No, when an item is pending before the board, our board is planning to hear a workshop on the draft or on... Oh, okay, no. The draft order has been released. There was a public comment period. The board held a workshop in February. The next step is that the board will have a hearing to consider adoption in August in Crescent City. And so because that is happening, it's totally fine for you to provide this comment in public forum, but the board can't discuss it right now because there are a whole bunch of people that are interested in this issue. And because we haven't noticed the public that the board would be having discussion, it wouldn't be appropriate for the board to have that discussion without others having the opportunity to be tuned into that. So, yeah. Your comment was fine. I was just cautioning the board not to get into an off agenda discussion. Okay. And sorry if I was belaboring that, because maybe no board members were planning to do that. But
thank you for coming over here and commenting, though. We appreciate it. Thank you. Emma, have we received any other requests?
There are no more requests.
Great. Okay. So, close that public comment session, and we're going to now move on to our final two agenda items, 8 and 9, executive officer's report, followed by any requests from board members for future agenda items or any general comments they may have. So, Valerie, I'll hand it over to you if you have anything.
I don't have too much. I already yesterday highlighted that the written EO's report includes a 5-year update on implementation of Green Diamond's Elk River waste discharge requirements. I also want to note that the executive officer's report includes a preview of another item that will come before the board, which is general waste discharge requirements for closed landfills. So that's kind of your first peek at that future general order development. And then I also wanted to, board members are aware of this, but I wanted to kind of report this for any public that's listening, that we did add a meeting to our schedule for this year. We added a board workshop on July 23rd for the board to conduct a workshop on a draft 13267 investigative order that would require information about roads from certain landowners in the Wallala River watershed. So I just wanted to highlight that because it's not something that was on our board schedule before. So if the public is you know, looking at our board schedule on the website, it's updated now. And so that's coming. Thanks.
Board members, are there any requests of staff or general comments?
I'm curious, Valerie, are the landowners notified of that meeting?
Certainly. Our staff has been doing pretty extensive outreach and engagement, and we will also do all the proper noticing for the release of the draft order in the board workshop.
Madam Chair, I wanted to thank, first of all, yesterday's presentation by Jim and Elizabeth on the Elk River. That was very informational. And then I'm kind of at a quandary on the comment from the Caltrout representative saying that there would be no improvement with the current action. And I just feel like, is there any way that the staff can look at how we can make some improvements in the watershed if we're kind of stuck, and whether it's more action in the impacted reaches going forward, maybe they need to take a different tact about how they improve the lower reaches if it's not going to be improved just with the current regulations.
May I add? Yeah. I also heard comments that Caltrout receives quite a bit of funding, but there's less results seen from all that funding. And I'm wondering if there's a project timeline or expectation that we could have Caltrout produce for us so that we can see results, so that people on the Elk River can see results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are big, complex questions. I will say that we don't agree that that what is happening currently will not lead to improvement, and we also acknowledge that more improvement is needed. This watershed has very big problems, and there's a lot of work that needs to occur. We don't, as Elizabeth outlined, there are various aspects of TMDL implementation. The waste discharge requirements are one of them. And then restoration and stewardship and monitoring or other aspects. So we will continue to work closely with Caltrout on those. Caltrout doesn't answer to our board, so we can't direct them to provide information to the board, but we can certainly, talk with them about their timelines and the board's interest in receiving that information, and get that to you to the extent that it's provided. We are constantly working with them and other partners, to creatively figure out where resources can come from and what will be the most impactful actions. We'll continue to do that. We're excited to work with their new regional director, Bill Matsubu. He just started a couple weeks ago, so I haven't had the chance to meet with him yet, but I'm looking forward to having, kind of a higher level partnership meeting to talk about some of those issues.
Can I add one piece? I just wanted to also clarify that Katie Gorin's comment was around the idea of a system that would fix itself, and she was noting that the information that they have is that if we don't do restoration, if we don't do significant work in the impacted reach, then it won't recover. That's one of the components of our action plan, is to support and work towards restoration. As mentioned, we don't have a lot of funding control over that, and so a lot of that work for us is support for organizations like Caltrout to do the work that they've done, that they're doing. And so I just wanted to be clear that it wasn't that nothing's going to happen in the watershed if we continue to do what we're doing. It's more that if you weren't to do any restoration, then it's not going to recover on its own. It's going to keep getting worse. It requires intervention in order to, in the impact of reach with restoration, in order to recover. And that's ongoing. Hopefully that was helpful.
With no other comments from the board, our next meeting is going to start at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, June 16th, 2026. It will be in Santa Rosa at the regional board's office at 5550 Sky Lane Boulevard, Suite A. With that, thank you everybody for your participation and attention, and have safe drives, travel home.